Friday, and welcome to Minute 160 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into The Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again, our guest from the entire week, is Hugh Keen from the National Treasure Minute. Welcome back, Hugh.
Thank you. I'm excited. I'm thankful it's Friday, and it's near the end of the, it's near the weekend.
Wait, were you thankful that we're going to stop talking about The Great Escape?
Oh, no.
Just about the weekend itself.
No, I would, you know, I would talk about The Great Escape every weekday.
Oh, okay. All right. That's a relief. I thought you were getting a little sick of talking about The Great Escape with me, so I appreciate that. So episode 160 begins with Roger leaning against the corner of the building on the side of the end of the street, and goes all the way till we get to see Preston letting out his say and beginning to speak. So, as we've been discussing all week, Roger is trying to avoid getting captured by the Germans who were after him after Mac made his slip-up earlier this week. Finally, he feels that yesterday one of the things was he was able to convince a German officer and the soldiers around him that he is a German citizen and there's no reason why they need to be suspicious of him. And right after that, he comes to the end of the street, leans up against the wall, seems very happy and relieved that he's finally made it and is safe. And then he hears a voice from behind him that calls out his name, Herr Bartlett.
Mm-hmm.
You see the fear on his face. He takes a few breaths, but he realizes that he's done for. There's nothing else that he can do to get out of this. He avoids turning around a little bit, and so we have a few more seconds of him, you know, contemplating his predicament, but he knows that there's nothing else he can do. And then he folds up the paper that he's looking and turns around.
Yep. Which doesn't, like, wouldn't, if you were really trying to sell that you weren't this person that they think you are, wouldn't you just not respond if you heard your English name?
That is very true.
But also, this one thing I want to ask you, since I know you're the authority on this movie.
The authority, I wouldn't say, but I'm among them.
is this Gestapo officer from earlier in the movie, or is this the first time we see him?
This is the first time we see him.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I knew I was going to sound dumb.
Yeah, this is an SS officer that we've never seen before.
Okay.
Now, I've always found this scene completely hilarious because of the fact that this actor looks so much like John Lovitz from Saturday Night Live and a lot of other things.
Yeah, he does look familiar.
It's not him, obviously, because John Lovitz was quite young in 1962 when they filmed this movie. So it isn't him.
Right, he does look similar.
But he does look like him, which always cracks me up. Mm-hmm. Especially the way that he speaks makes it sound as if he's, you know, doing a John Lovitz. I mean, John Lovitz was born in 1957, so he was five. So this is definitely not John Lovitz.
He does seem very full of, like, it seems like he's playing a character. Like,
yes.
He seems very full of himself.
Yeah. Now, the German officer then says, Ich heißen Freilich. Okay? Now, I tried looking that up, and anyone out there who understands German that might be able to correct me, you know, I'd love to hear from you by any of the social media to explain what exactly he says, because the only translation that I was able to find is him saying, my name is Happy, which makes no sense whatsoever. I'm not really sure.
I mean, he could just be saying, like, I am happy.
But why would he say,
like,
that?
Because he found him, because he, you know.
No, but this is,
wait, are you saying Bartlett said this? Oh, okay.
Bartlett says this to him, which doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense then.
And the response that the German officer gives is, your German is good. And I also hear that your French is. Which shows that, again, I've mentioned this a few times this week, and you know, I've mentioned a lot in this discussion of the movie in general. They really were able to mess up the works by causing this escape. I mean, the fact that this random German officer knows so much about Bartlett at this point, that he knows that he's, you know, good in German and good in French, even though maybe he just heard it from the Gestapo guy that we saw earlier this week. It's possible.
Yeah.
But still, to know that information so quickly is, you know, says how much, you know, how high he was on their wanted list that they wanted to make it. And when he says this, he really does, once again, sounds like John Lovitz, and you know, him looking like it is great also. And at this point, he pulls out his gun.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a very comical way, he goes, your arms up,
yep.
Which is just a very strange way that someone would actually say this. Bartlett at this point is aware of the fact that he's beaten, and he basically raises his hand in surrender. And you see, you can see the fear in his face again, which, as we know, Bartlett is, throughout the entire movie, is fearless. And at this point, we see that he's finally, you know, he's done for.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that we discussed yesterday was this red thing behind him. So we get a little more of a look at it, but I still can't figure out what it is.
Yeah, can't either.
It doesn't make any sense, because it looks as if there are pieces of wood behind it. So maybe... Is it possible that it's a window to get into some sort of store or something like that? You know, that like maybe this is maybe they sell things through a window. Again, yeah, I don't know. I'm just giving a guess.
And it's just boarded up.
Everything's boarded up. Mm-hmm. You know, as we said, Roger's caught, raises his hands in defeat. Now, one of the things I wanted to mention all week that I decided to wait until today to discuss is how this whole scenario of Roger and Mac escaping plays out in the original script. In the original script, it's pretty much half a page. It's done very shortly. We have the scene where they're trying to get up on the bus, and they have the conversation with the Gestapo officer. And then as soon as Mac says thanks, I mean, first of all, the Gestapo man says, good luck, chum. He doesn't even just say good luck. He throws in the word chum. Donald then says thanks.
Okay.
And that's it. They get caught. There's no mention of them running. There's no mention of them, you know, Mac getting knocked over by a bicycle. There's no Bartlett running across a roof and putting his hands on barbed wire. There's no two other officers stopping and questioning Bartlett. So I found that very interesting. I mean, I don't know the answer to this, but there obviously was a lot of work done between the original draft of the script and the final script of... You know, the fact that they've added now pretty much almost 5 minutes of, or let's say 4 full minutes, because we had Cedric at the beginning of the week also. Which, again, according to the original script, that wasn't even Cedric. That was a character named Mary Vale, who doesn't appear at all in the movie. Cedric actually, the character named Cedric gets caught in the shot in the original script. So they switched that around also. Yes, Sedgwick in the original script does a lot of things that Cavendish does.
Okay.
So they switched around, I guess, who says what and how they do it and what they do along the way. So, no, that's just...
Interesting.
It's an interesting discrepancy that they have.
Well, maybe that explains why this scene's such cut, like, the way it is, and shots, like, in so many different, like, it looks like time, like, diff times or, like, different street areas, and it's, like, almost pieced together, because maybe they had the full cut of the movie done based off the script, and they were like, well, we need something here, and they looked at this part of the movie, and maybe they were like, well, this wasn't spectacular enough of a, like, of them getting captured, and so
make it more thrilling.
Yeah, and so they went out and they were like, well, we can just shoot these scenes in 2 days, and they just shot the footage, and then they just stuck it together, and that's why it sort of has some continuity issues.
Could be.
And it would also explain what you were saying about the line of people at the bus, because maybe they shot it first, and the first time they shot it, they just had them get caught, and then they were like, oh, we need to redo the whole bus scene now, because they're going to run away, and that's why they had to get more people. I'm not sure. But
that could be. That's a great theory. I like that. Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, the script that I have is from April 26, 1962. It's a version of the script by James Clavell. So, you know, and we know that they filmed this not long after in 1962. So maybe just a few months later, there are a lot of discrepancies between this version of the script and the movie itself, which I've discussed throughout the course of this whole podcast. I've mentioned a lot of them. Not all of them, but you know, anyone who wants to get a copy of that, you can find a copy online of this script also, if you want to sit down and read the whole script.
Okay.
And so at this point, we then get a switch of the scene, and we get to see Prison and Dietrich. We get to see Dietrich on the phone, and Prison is sitting at a desk looking at various documents, trying to figure out what is going on. And then the phone rings, and Dietrich answers the phone. Bonds excellent in German, which is ausgezeichnet, something like that. Once again, I apologize to all my German listeners who will see how I have been completely gargling and boggling and destroying the German language. So I apologize for that. And he then, Dietrich looks at Prisen and doesn't even say to him what's going on. You know, he's excited about something. He gives him a look, and then he pushes the button on the little contraption on the desk in order to, I guess, it's a door buzzer at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Then he puts his hat on, which I found really interesting, because I guess he wants something to be done in a much more formal way. You know, in a respectful way, where he puts on his hat. He doesn't tell Prisen to put on a hat, but he puts his on. You know, I also love the way he's holding his gloves in his hand. You know, as we've seen a lot of movies with Nazis, you know, they're always holding gloves in their hands as opposed to having to wear them, you know, for whatever reason. And then we get a shot, the door opens.
Yeah.
We see Bartlett enter, and he's standing with an actor named Carl Otto Alberti. Have you ever seen him before?
Okay. Let me look at him again. He's in the hallway with him.
Okay. Have you ever seen the movie Kelly's Heroes?
I cannot say I have seen that man before.
So he plays the German tank commander.
I don't know.
Ends up joining in with the crew of trying to break into this bank to steal all the gold. So I just love the fact that you actually recognize him here. You know, he doesn't have very much to do in this whole movie. He's in this scene, and then he's in another scene towards the end of the movie, and that's it.
That's funny, because he's like, because of just all the other people that seemingly have bigger roles not being credited.
Yes, exactly. And maybe he's credited on IMDb because of the fact that it's an actor that's easily recognizable.
That makes sense.
You know, it could be. Because it's mentioned on IMDb that he's uncredited. You know, it's not as if they say that, oh, actually, no, he is credited. I apologize. There's one British officer that's uncredited. He's actually credited.
I see.
Maybe he was considered a big German box office draw at the time. So they decided to give him his due credit here. I like the fact that we see that Roger is in handcuffs. You know, they don't want to take any chances with him. They're taking all precautions possible.
Mm-hmm. I also thought it was interesting. I feel like nowadays, if this scene was to take to the movie,
his hands would be behind him.
The door would... What?
His hands would be
I didn't even think about that. What I was going to say was, as soon as the door opens, he would be being shoved through the door. Like, there would be some violence with which he is brought into this room. But they sort of just, like, have a stare down, and then he walks in.
It's as if they leave him standing in the doorway for a few extra seconds so that Prisen can take it in of what just has happened. Because Prisen has a very, very happy look on his face.
Mm-hmm.
He lets out a big sigh. He's quite joyous. And we see that he gets to fold his hands across his, you know, across one another, as Roger and Steiner, Carl Otto Alberti, you know, walking towards the desk. Yep. I mean, I love the layout of this room. It looks like this is, you know, maybe it was either filmed or took place in some sort of castle, or things look very antique. You know, you have the antique chair against the, you know, near the door. You have what looks like a cupboard on the left-hand side. The lamps on top, you know, hanging down from the ceiling, look also a little more antique with the way that they show it. So I like the way that they lay out this room, you know, because we don't know where it takes place. So the question is this something,
that's true.
You know, is this type of place which, you know, the Gestapo headquarters are, or is this something that's just being used temporarily along the way?
Yeah, my first note about the setting was, the first thing I wrote was, is there any way you can get a more depressing office? Because it's very, like, dark and concrete. But then, like, I immediately wrote after that, I was like, I guess the point is that they want to be secluded. Like they are the Gestapo, after all. So even if it's a temporary station for them, they still don't want, like, people to walk by and look in the window, you know, and be like, oh, well, the Gestapo are in the office today. You know,
right, but so, on the other hand, they probably, you're right. I definitely agree with what you said there. But I think also that the idea that this may be a dungeon is more to intimidate the prisoners when they come in.
That makes sense, yeah.
You know, both work with what you said and what I said. I mean, they go hand in hand.
It reminds me of the, it actually reminds me of the, room that, did you watch The Mandalorian?
Yes.
It reminds me of the room that he meets the... I don't know what the name of the actor is. He meets the old guy who sends him to get Baby Yoda.
Oh.
And that's like a concrete room.
Werner Herzog.
Yeah. So this room reminds me of that room, which I thought sort of funny.
That's actually interesting.
Because, like, all the places
I assume
that,
it's not the same set.
Yeah, probably not. You think they shot this... they shot The Great Escape in a big LED... big exactly. 360 LED. That's why it looks so good.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it depends on what copy you have, but yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. Do you have anything else for this minute?
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, just... It's a very interesting... One thing this movie does, which most good movies do, is what screenwriters talk about, which is showing and not telling. So showing the audience this narrative instead of just having the dialogue explain it. And I think this scene's a good example, or at least this minute we got, because almost everything that happens in the minute we're looking at is nonverbal. Like there's yes. The phone call, but it's in German. So like, I don't know, like I didn't know what he was saying before you told me. And so you have to assume by his body language and his excitedness and the fact that he avoids telling his boss what he's excited about before he pages the person in, like you have to read all that to understand what's happening. And then obviously the body language between Roger when the door opens and the bad guy sitting in at his desk. And then even further into the minute near the end where the guy goes, which is like, you couldn't really consider that verbal either, but it's obviously satisfaction.
Yes.
So
I just, all the actors here just do a great job in this scene, showing us everything that's going on without having to actually say it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, next week we'll get more into the whole conversation about what Preston actually says, because as he opens his mouth to begin speaking, that's when this minute actually ends.
I went and I did some more research about the real event, which you probably have already talked about quite a bit, seeing as we're pretty far in the movie. But I always, like I said, I first watched this with my father when I was a kid. And we had a VHS, we had it on VHS, and since it's 3 hours long, it's a double VHS set. Anyway, when I was a kid, I always thought it was a fake story. I don't think I ever read the stuff at the beginning or the end where it talks about, you know, it being a true story. Because that's not really something, you don't pay attention to words in a movie when you're a kid, like that are written on the screen.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that don't do that either. So
anyway, I think it was quite a while I thought that this movie was like, obviously World War II happened, but like this story of these men getting out of a prisoner of war camp, I thought it was just sort of like a dream, like a movie. Somebody was like, oh, this would be cool if it had happened. I think, I don't know when I there's multiple documentaries about it, but I think I saw one where they actually went back and revisited the camp, the remnants of the camp, and like looked at, saw if they could find any tunnels that were left. And I don't think they found much, but I just think it's ironic that I always thought it was not true. And then another thing that I thought was crazy about the real part, which we talked about at the beginning of the week, was that it happened in like the coldest winter Poland had had in like who knows how many years or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't imagine like trying to do like I'm from the Midwest and like I can't imagine anything in the coldest winters we've had like for leisure. And so I don't like I think it's incredible to imagine possibly how many of them would have got out if it hadn't been winter.
Yeah.
Like, or like how far they would have made it. Like, it's really unfortunate that that happened. Is that the same winter that like Germany tried to attack Russia and everybody died in the cold?
No, that was 1942. That's a different winter. This winter, 1944, it was even before D-Day. So, I mean, that's the interesting thing. In the original story, this happened before D-Day, but in the movie, it happens after D-Day.
Interesting.
Even though they don't mention anything about D-Day, because, I mean, we know that it's after D-Day because of the whole July 4th celebrations.
That makes sense.
So that's interesting, the way that you place when this took place, when the story, when the movie takes place, as opposed to when the original story took place a few months earlier.
Yeah.
Wow, that's funny. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think the last thing I have to say is this movie, for better or worse, increased my ability to be good at lying. Because I think the main scene that I hold on to from this movie, and it's sort of ironic that I got the minutes that it happened in, is where he gets caught saying thank you on the bus. Like, I think that was that's the scene I can remember most vividly from this movie, from the first times I watched it, because I was like, it's such a jar that they get caught, because that whole scene, you're like, oh, they made it, or like, oh, they've got this, you know, they're getting on the bus, and then he messes it up because he falls out of character.
And that's the way they keep the suspense going, because they make you think that everything's fine, when in reality, it apparently is not.
And so I think the impact of seeing someone fail at such a, like, moment importance to, like, keep the facade is, like, I don't know. I'm not proud of being a good liar, but I think it's definitely, I don't know. I think it's really just they nailed it in this movie. Thanks for having me on this week. And glad I got to talk about that minute, because that minute, like, means to me.
Wow.
So
you see, it's divine providence that that's what you got.
Yeah, it had to have been.
This is the first time that I've had one of their guests tell me that, you know, that they somehow got some of the best minutes that they would have wanted, even though it was all randomly done, you know, without having to ask for it.
Now that I'm thinking about it, I think the reason I took so much from it when I was little was because that's a scene that a kid can understand. Like, you can understand as soon as he double takes after he says that he did something wrong. like every kid has that feeling when they are trying to get away with something and they don't, of like, oh shoot, it didn't work out. I'm going to get in trouble now. And so it's like, I think that's why it was so impactful. And then it's funny, cause the only other scene I remember that I had of from when I first watched it is when he throws the baseball over the wire at the inning.
Mm-hmm.
And that must just be because kids like baseball, or like, I like sports, because for some reason that's him having a baseball is also very memorable to me. So,
oh, wow.
Okay. Anyway.
Great. Now, have you ever told your father that you appreciate him showing you this movie as a kid so you were able to hone your skills at deceiving
people? I have not.
Well, now you can tell.
Yeah, you're right. It's been very...
Hopefully he will be a proud father to hear that.
It's funny. It's just been a very... Like, whenever I do this for National Treasure, it's just... It's very... I mean, I'm sure you realize this, but it's very introspective for you, like, as a person. Because you're not only, like... And you're not only looking through it and taking notes on what's happening in the movie, you're, like, associating the times of your life that you went through when you watched the movie, you know?
Yes, so, completely.
I guess that's why everybody loves this medium so much. But
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope that's the reason. Yeah. All right, well, do you want to once again, for the final time, tell people I can get in touch with you in order to get great designs by you?
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to any design work, you can find my portfolio at hughkeen.com. You can also find me on Facebook or Instagram. You can find me in the Star Wars Minute Listener Society, which is somewhere where you should be to pay your respects to the creators. And yeah, Pete Nox.
So Pete Nox. Alex was on this months ago. He did one episode.
Nice.
In the middle, episode 71, yeah. If I remember.
And then you're welcome to come listen to National Treasure Minute, which you can find on moviesbyminutes.com, I think, is the address for the main site. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. I mean, as of recording, there are over 200 Movies by Minute podcasts that are currently going on. And since we're recording this months in advance, that number hopefully has grown exponentially ever since then. Just this way people will know more or less when this was recorded.
There'll probably be like 40 more Star Wars movies by then, so.
Who knows? You never know. I don't think Pete and Alex will be able to get 40 more podcasts done in that amount of time. We're not talking years. You can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you're using to listen to this show. Our Facebook group is The Cooler. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. Our email address is minute@gmail.com. And our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. So hopefully everyone will have a great weekend. Once again, thank you, Hugh, for joining us this week. It's been a lot of fun. Hopefully you enjoyed yourself, too.
Yep. It was great.
All right. Until Monday, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.